stars of animation are shining. It's time to stay tuned. And now, here's your host, Phil Mackey.
Hey there, folks, and welcome back to Stay Tuned. You're in store for another look behind the scenes of animated films and shows with the people who make it all possible. Tonight's special guest is Andy Sorsini. Film editor Andy Sorsini may not have originally planned on a long-standing career with Disney Animation, but it's clear the two work successfully hand in hand. From TV series like Aladdin, The Mighty Ducks, and Timon and Pumbaa, to feature animated films like The Tigger Movie and Cinderella 2, Andy now finds himself among a world of adventuring frogs with Amphibia. This new series for Disney Channel has already been greenlit for a second season, and we're going to find out just what it takes to cut a show like Amphibia together in just a few moments. But first, this. Andy Sorsini, welcome to Stay Tuned.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here on the show.
It's a pleasure to have a fellow Italian.
Yes. Yes. Formally, it's pronounced Sorcini, but I, you know, within the industry, I think it's just sort of been mangled to Sorsini enough that I'm like, you know what? Whatever. I'll take it.
I love it. Yes. Yeah. Sorcini. That's a very Italian name. Have you visited Italy at all?
No, not yet. I plan to at some point in my life. It'd be nice to go back to the old country.
Yes. I got to visit Sicily last year for the first time.
Oh, how was it?
It was incredible. And after being there for nearly 2 weeks, I found it difficult to want to come back.
Yeah. Our people come from Spoleto, which is somewhere in the middle of the country.
Oh.
And I'd love to go there at some point.
I'll have to keep that town in mind.
Yeah, it's a beautiful looking country. I've seen pictures.
Oh, yes. The pictures are lovely. So, Andy, you are an animatic editor. Did I say that correctly? Is that the right title?
Yes, well, an editor, a film editor in general, and I cut animatics, which is the pre-production aspect of the workflow, but I also cut the color for when the animation comes back. So both animatic editor and final color editor.
Thank you for the clarification, because I did not know that. And, you know, as a reminder to listeners, the animatic is essentially a rough draft for a cartoon. It's got minimal movement, just enough to kind of quickly communicate pacing and story beats. That leads me to my next question, which is, what is a day in the life of an editor like?
Well, you happen to catch me in the scope of the production that I'm working on right now, which is Disney's Amphibia. In second season animatics. So I am deep in the heart of the animatic process. So in general, like a week for me will start off when I'm building an animatic, will start off, I'll get the storyboard panels on a Monday, say, and it generally amounts to quite a few hundred, maybe close to 1,000, depending on the length of the show. And I will take those panels and I will import them into a nonlinear editor. In this case, it's Avid Film Composer.
Yeah.
And I will lay those out on the timeline, pacing them out the way that I feel to emulate movement of animation. Providing that I have enough panels to do that with, yeah, I'll time it out as a guide for the next stage, which is when we ship it overseas to have it animated. So when they see that, basically, it's a guide to help our director and our showrunners convey what that animation is supposed to look like in its final form. Throughout the course of the week, I'll cut those panels together, build the entire show, and also cut them against production dialogue that we have and cut in temporary sound effects and temporary music.
That's fascinating. And what I think is really cool, just to kind of give people a sense of timing, I just watched the premiere of Amphibia season one.
Yeah.
That just came out. So just to give everybody a sense of scope, Andy's working on season two. Season one is just emerging right now, right?
Yeah. And season one, the entire season of Amphibia will be done within the course of 5 weeks. So,
wow.
So there'll be a long, long wait until season two color comes back and is ready for air. So as people who've been listening to your show probably get the sense of at this point, animation is a very long, involved process.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you watch like the DVD extras for a lot of Disney films, you can usually go in and watch some animatics and they look like typically black and white, very minimal moving, almost like a comic book sort mm-hmm. of some sort of thing. But what does color editing mean? What is that all about?
After the animatics have been sent overseas, the scenes have been animated and we get the full color animation back as individual scenes, then my job is to take those scenes and drop them in over the animatic build so that they match essentially scene to scene with the timing that we had in the animatic. And then I will work with the directors and the showrunners to massage that episode to the air length that we are contracted to deliver to the network.
Giant head, bendy limbs, face bumps. The Beast!
Stop following me.
I have bad news for you, Beast. I taste terrible.
Ew, I am not going to eat you.
You tried to eat Wally?
I tried to ask Wally for help. He ran off screaming the second he saw me.
That does sound like Wally.
So if it's like a 11-minute episode, what we get back is usually over length. We generally ship over length to give us the latitude to sort of play around with the timing.
Absolutely.
And within the course of the editing process, we will massage it to time and get it to the right length. But not only that, but also reevaluate from a story structure point if scenes are playing right, if scenes need to be moved around, if entire scenes can be dropped because they're just not essential to the narrative. And also within the process of our color editing timeline, we are doing retakes. So we're sending out scenes that came in not quite correct and sending them back overseas or sending them to our in-house production team to tweak and get right so that it's essentially as perfect as we can make it before it goes on air.
I've said it before and I will say it again. The process of sending animation back and forth, it sounds like an eternal game of telephone.
Mm-hmm. It's often a lot of trying to communicate something that seems intangible. it's all subjective. So when a showrunner or director is looking at a scene coming back from overseas or coming back from wherever it's animated, and they're like, they're just not feeling it, then they have to, we sit in a process that colloquially at Disney we call sweatbox, which is a term that goes back to Walt Disney's days.
Yes.
When Disney used to get his animators in a small, hot room and put the pressure of scrutiny on them. And so it would be hot and sweaty, both because it was a small, cramped room and also because the animators were literally like in a hot seat under Walt's eye.
Because nothing says productivity and creativity like shoving a bunch of guys into a room and telling them how much they suck.
Yes. But then it's that process of trying to convey to the retake crew what sort of intangible, what subjective things are not working with the scene and how to make it better. And oftentimes it is technical stuff like we have problems with lip flap, or we decide that we need to have a different line of dialogue in there to convey the meaning of the scene. So we'll scratch something in and then have the voice talent record ADR to match that. And then we have to have our team, our retake team, redo the lip sync to match the new ADR to get it to working right. It's all, I like to think of it as the animatic process is really the creative process where you are creating the mood of the episode, and the post-production process is really all problem solving, like fine-tuning it until it gets to match your vision.
So it's like building a house. You really want to have that good foundation in there.
Yep.
And then, you know, you can focus on how nice that roof looks once you've got an actual structure.
Yeah, precisely, precisely. The animatic process is building the foundation and the structure of the house, and the post-production process is the varnishing and the finishing nails and like the fine detail work.
Yes, and then you stand back and you realize, oh no, we didn't put enough load-bearing walls.
That often happens too. My career goes back to when we would edit on film and cut things on an editorial bench. And
oh, wow.
Yeah, very often in that process, we would have what was known as second air retakes, which was when the show had been finalized and went to the network and it aired on TV, the showrunner would watch it on TV and he'd be like, or he or she would be like, oh, I just noticed this retake. And it's after the fact. Show's already aired, but I've noticed this retake. And then we'd correct them for the archival version. So we'd correct them. And then when the show got put away forever and ever, it would be correct in that version.
Ah, so the version that people see initially on TV might be a one-of-a-kind little gem.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, interesting.
But those were that was back in the day, back in the early days of Disney Channel.
Back to the Gargoyles days.
Exactly, that era.
Yeah.
So we don't do that anymore.
And that's where the term cutting room floor comes from, right? Because you would literally cut the film, and if it wasn't used, it would fall on the floor.
It would end up on the floor or in a bin somewhere.
Yeah.
Are you guys ready to make our pizza dreams a pizza reality?
Pizza dreams!
Oh, maybe we should put pineapple on it. Seems like a natural fit.
Don't you dare talk about pineapple on my pizza. Ever.
Okay, let's go get those ingredients.
You know, I love Batman the Animated Series, which is not related to Disney at all. But
it's a classic.
It is a classic. But one of the things that I love about the commentaries that they would do on there is they would talk about the various animation teams overseas who would do the in-betweens. And through watching and listening to those commentaries, I would start to learn names of animation companies I didn't know anything about.
Sure.
I'm guessing Disney does the same thing where they have multiple places they will send the work through. Is there one that when it comes back and you know it came from that one that you're like, yes, these guys always nail it?
I think that varies from project to project. Like, for example, on season one of Amphibia, we had three different studios. And as we went through the season, we discovered that two of them were fairly outstanding and one of them just had problems sort of keeping up.
Off-model stuff, you mean?
Off-model stuff, or didn't quite get the flow of the animation the way that we were looking for. Like, it's not a slam against that studio in general. It's just this particular collaboration of the team that they were using with our project. So it differs every time. And in other cases, that particular studio may have done really outstanding on another project. So it varies, you know, it varies from project to project. It varies from studio to studio. I think a good rule of thumb, if you're a showrunner and you're working on starting up a new show, is to not put all of your eggs in one overseas studio basket. Like, you want to at least have two so that you can anticipate problems like this and have a fallback.
That makes sense. Yeah. As I understand it, a non-animated film as a reference here, like Alien 3 is a good example of this. yeah, you already know where I'm going with this. That's funny.
It's just interesting. Alien 3 has actually come up a lot in the last few weeks.
Oh, really?
Just completely unrelated to animation, but it's sort of like it's one of those Bader Meinhof phenomenon things where you happen to mention Alien 3 and I'm like, oh my god, Alien 3, how is it that Alien 3 is coming up in this conversation? go on.
well, because that film, it stands out in my mind as one of those movies where there are definitely multiple cuts. The editor had a huge effect over the outcome of what we got to see. It changes the tonality. It changes the story. It changes like everything. Yeah. I don't think people know how powerful editors really are. Has there ever been a version of anything, going back to the mid-90s Disney Afternoon stuff, has there ever been a version of something that you cut together that you preferred and it did not make it to broadcast at all?
That is a very good question. And I have to think, because a lot of the stuff that I do is more or less episodic. So in general, because of the teams that we have, for the most part, we tend to work it until the cream rises to the top. So what ends up on air is usually the best version of whatever it is. Like there are some, the project that I worked on before this project I'm working on now is Amphibia, but just before that I worked on a show called Billy Dilly's Super Duper Subterranean Summer.
And it rolls right off the tongue.
Yeah. And we had some episodes that I felt were really, we really pushed some envelopes in the animatic phase and even in color. But unfortunately, so a lot of that stuff could not, for one reason or another, make it to air. And so a lot of it ended up being compromised by a bit. And I think that was just one of those situations where the style of the show going into the project did not necessarily mesh with what the network wanted to see coming out of the production. But that just happens sometimes. You know, sometimes the one creator's vision, when, if you're a showrunner and you're bringing your project to a network, particularly like a Disney and the Disney Channel, you can expect that there's going to be a lot of compromise along the way to get it to a version that is palatable. But to, I will say that to Disney's credit, they do like to push the envelope themselves too. So they're willing to entertain your vision and help you have your vision. But sometimes the vision is just so out there that the world is not quite ready for it.
Interesting. I'm really wondering what you mean by that.
Well, I can't, unfortunately, I can't show you any of the
because
it's just, it doesn't exist in a final, any sort of final form.
So that show didn't actually get to air then?
No, it did air. The entire season aired. But like I said, some of the episodes were aired in a somewhat compromised version from what the showrunner, the show creator.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Interesting.
That showrunner was Aaron Springer. And if you know Aaron Springer, he has some outrageous visions. And if allowed to like really roam free form, he is capable of some really outstanding, irreverent stuff. And I think that it was just a fit that was not quite suited to his vision.
Okay.
Unfortunately. So that was.
So gone are the days where we're going to find inappropriate posters in the back of the rescuers.
Yeah. Yeah. Like all stuff like that gets gone through with a fine tooth comb by our legal team and standards and practices. So none of that, especially on episodic TV basis. Now, I don't even think you can get away with that kind of stuff in feature film anymore.
Well, you know, it's a sign of the times.
Yeah.
More with Andy Sorsini after this. You know, a lot of artists know about reaching a sort of zen state when working on a project. Does that happen to you when you're editing? And if it does, what gets you to that place? What do you find gets you there best?
Oh, yeah. Well, that is usually when I have this sort of vision in my head about how I'm going to cut a scene and the emotional impact that I want it to have when I'm done with it. And I put it together and it all works exactly the way that I envisioned. I do get that sort of zen state, and I do get a little giddy about that, I'll be honest with you.
Sure.
Like even the very first episode that I cut in season one of Amphibia, Flood, Sweat, and Tears. Yeah, so it was originally called Flooding the Basement, and the name changed somewhere through the...
The one I saw online, it says Best Franz. That's the one I watched. Is that not correct?
Right. Anne or Beast and Best Franz, that was the pilot episode. But the first episode that I cut, because we will often... We'll produce these out of order. So first episode I cut was Flood, Sweat, and Tears. And I didn't cut Best Franz until a little bit later on in the production schedule. They all air in the correct order. We just produced them out of order.
The show is very polished. I mean, it's got a really crisp look to it.
That is the result of literally dozens of people watching these episodes over and over and over again and catching little mistakes. When we have our, what we call our playback, where we watch the episode all together as a group before we send it off to the channel, everyone goes through and has their, we'll watch it all, and we open the forum up for everyone to sort of find any sort of mistakes that threw them off.
Okay.
There's literally dozens of eyes watching it at the same time and pointing out every little possible mistake.
So I mean, that's good to know. There's that much scrutiny that goes into it.
Yeah. So as far as animation mistakes, they should be minimal on this particular show.
That's very evident. It was a very clean, polished show.
Anyhow, I'm afraid I can't do much for you. That cane was made with wood from the incredibly rare, extremely dangerous Doom Tree. Few have made it to the Doom Tree alive. Fewer yet returned. It holds many secrets that mortals dare not.
Dude, it's a tree. Just tell us where it is.
Yeah, Loggle, cut the chit-chat.
You're bald!
Okay, okay. I got a map to the Doom Tree right here. But it'll cost you.
Click.
Or you could do that.
You know, I don't understand this phenomenon, but I'm going to tell you about it. I'm sure you're going to know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I've noticed since I was a kid. I can own a movie. It could be on my shelf. It could be my favorite movie, whatever. And I've seen it a million times. I've got it memorized. But for some reason, if I'm flipping channels and the movie's on, I'm like, oh, the movie's on. I could watch it whenever I want because I own the movie. But I get more excited that somebody else put it on. Do you know what I'm talking about?
There's absolutely something to that where it's the immediacy of it. It's the immediacy and it's the fact that it just came on and it's just immediately available. It's something that you hadn't thought about. You know, if you stop and think about, oh, I'm going to put this thing on, it's a different...
Spontaneity is lost.
Yeah, it's a different mindset than it just being on and you just being into it. That's why you can like change a channel and catch a movie like 10 minutes into it and end up sitting and watching the entire rest of the movie.
So you've obviously, my reason for bringing that up, I actually did have a reason. You've watched these shows as an editor countless times.
Yep.
Does that happen where the episode will come on and you're just like, hey, I know that show. I just got done editing that show. And you'll just sit there and watch it even though you've just got done, you know, editing the heck out of it?
You know, not so much with the stuff that the most recent stuff that I've worked on, but I worked on Gravity Falls and occasionally an episode of that will come on and I will be like, oh, this is cool. And I'll just sit and end up watching the entire thing.
Well, Gravity Falls was also an incredibly well-made show.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a labor of love.
Yeah, I know a lot of fans were very heartbroken that it was not slated to come back per the request of the creator.
Yeah, I mean, the idea with that was that there was one story that was being told. That story had a very definitive beginning, middle, and end, and it fulfilled that narrative arc. And that was it. That was all the story there was to tell from that.
You know, now that we're in this strange age of streaming services and Disney especially about to be launching their own Disney Plus service, you mentioned really early in our conversation about the 11-minute episode. And of course, with half an hour shows, they either just have two episodes or the more sitcom-y type shows will do 22 minutes for one story. I mean, 22 minutes for one story.
Sure.
But, you know, now that we're going to this streaming stuff, that's going to change the rules, don't you think? Or do you foresee us adhering to those standard rules we've always clung to?
Well, I'm not working on any of the Disney Plus stuff at the moment, so I can't speak to it with any certainty. But I believe that you're right, that it does open up to more of a flexibility in show length. And as an editor, I feel like that's fantastic. If we can sort of take the time and tell the story that we need to tell and not necessarily try to force the narrative within a structured time limit box, that is better for me as an editor and better for the audience and better for the showrunner to be able to tell the story that they want to tell and better as an audience to absorb that story at the proper narrative pace. So, and I have personally been in plenty of situations where we had to make compromises to get the show to a particular length. And I felt like if we only had just a few more seconds of breathing room to let those stories like breathe and I don't know, because I'm too close to it, I don't know if it really would have made a difference. I can't see it objectively from an audience perspective. Maybe it would not have made any difference at all, but those are the constraints that we have, unfortunately.
Sure. And I like that, the idea of letting the narrative breathe, because these time signatures are kind of arbitrary.
Yeah. And I feel like that is going away with all of these bespoke networks and creating content that isn't beholding to sponsors.
This caterpillar looks exactly like my cat Domino from back home. I love my cat more than anything in the world. She was irreplaceable. But now I found a replacement. Let's take her home with us.
You don't typically hear, and I don't mean this in any insulting way. You don't typically hear someone say, when I grow up, I want to be an editor. So, is this something that people typically aspire and plan for? Or do you think it's more of a job that along the way you realize, wow, this is really cool. I didn't know this was even a thing. And then you kind of happen into it.
That is also an excellent question or observation.
That's what they pay me for.
I have told my showrunner on at least a couple of occasions that I feel like I'm the, I asked him at one point, you know, who's your favorite band? And he named for me his favorite band. And I said, well, who's the lead singer of that band? And he was able to name the lead singer. And I said, well, now who's the drummer? And he wasn't able to name the drummer. So I feel like film editors are kind of the drummers of the rock band.
But I can actually answer that question if you were to ask me that question.
Oh, sure. I'm sure. But you know, the point is that we keep the time, we set the pace, but we're not out there as rock show men. You know, we're not there taking the stage and soaking in the glory. But yeah, I think that for me personally, I started an animation on a show called Rover Dangerfield.
Yes.
It was a movie distributed by Warner Brothers, made by a studio called Hyperion Animation. And I started there as a production assistant and a runner. So I drive film from point to point. And from there, I went over to Disney. I worked at Amblin for a little while, and all in animation. And at a certain point in my career, I had to make a decision for myself, because I'm like, where I was going was not really going anywhere. So I have to decide, I definitely want to be involved as a filmmaker, but do I want to do that as an artist and try and develop my artistic skills, or do it in a more sort of craft-focused arena? And I chose to do it in a more craft focused arena. And that happened to be editorial, because it's something that I felt a bit of a connection to. So I developed those skills and started as an apprentice editor on the Tigger movie.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And from that point became an assistant editor and then a full editor. And the rest, as they say, is history. But I think it was just a decision for me to continue to be in the motion picture industry, but do it at a creative level. Not that production isn't creative, but I wanted to be hands-on, to have a tactile, immediate connection to the creative process.
Wow, that's really interesting. And feature animation, your experience in that is very different than working in the television side, or does it function pretty much the same way, just on a smaller scale?
That's a great question. And there is definitely an answer to that. The difference, I would say, is that in episodic TV, we are schedule oriented. So we have a definite timeline that we have to produce one particular episode in. And then we just rinse, lather, repeat that, you know, 22, 26 times a season. Because our schedule is so deadline oriented, we can't really stop. And at a certain point, we have to sort of let go of the process and give in to sort of the compromise that is part of the creative process and say, okay, well, this is as good as we can make it, but we can't dwell on it and we can't overwork the story because we have, you know, 25 more of these episodes to make. Whereas in feature animation, you have 2 or 3 years to really develop a story, and you will go through, you will put an entire story up on reels from start to finish several times during that process. It's sort of like as a sculptor, when you start with this big block of clay and you chip down and it looks a little bit more cubist, but you're starting right. to get the form of a human shape in there. And you just chip away and chip away and refine until it is like Michelangelo's David standing in front of you. It's that same process where you put up the entire show and it's generally there. The story is generally there. Some things aren't working structurally. And then you just go back and refine and have quite a few more screenings where you put those reels up, the entire show. And maybe this sequence isn't working, so you scrap the entire sequence and you start all over again. You write a new sequence, and now you've done that, another sequence isn't working, and it's just a longer process to become more refined. The stakes are generally higher on a feature film as well.
And then the censors come in and they take the fig leaf and put it over Michelangelo's David.
Yeah. Yes. Well, if it's a Disney feature, yes.
Correct.
Order up. Enjoy.
Mmm. That's good.
I'll take the maggot larb. Did I say that right? Larb?
It's actually pronounced lab.
Well, how about that? One foot in the grave and still learning new things.
Well, so Amphibia is now running on Disney Channel, correct?
That's correct. It's airing on Disney Channel and also on the Disney Now app. And even after it's done on Disney Channel, you can continue to find it on the Disney Now app.
And that's how people support editors. They watch the show. Is that, would you say, the best way to do it?
Yeah. And also connect with us on Twitter as well. Twitter and Tumblr. If you just do a hashtag Amphibia search on Twitter, you'll find the fan base and the crew. So you can connect with the crew. You can find me at Mr. Baby Man. That's my Twitter handle. Yeah. The showrunner for Amphibia, Matt Brawley, he is at Rad Rappy. That's R-A-D-R-A-P-P-Y. And he would love to hear, if you like the show, he would love to hear about it.
That's fantastic. I'm sure people will absolutely take you up on that. And I, of course, I have to ask before you go, Mr. Baby Man?
Ugh. It was the shortest version is that it was a term of endearment that my girlfriend, when I was creating my social media handle,
okay.
my girlfriend at the time, who is currently my wife, gave me that term of endearment. And it was the kind of thing that just stuck, and now I'm stuck with it. I mean, I suppose I could change my social media, but the weird thing about that is, and this is completely unrelated to animation at all.
That's
whatsoever.
Okay. That's all right.
So in the time that I created my social media handle, since then I had become the top user on a social media site called dig.com, which was the precursor to something like a Reddit. It was one of the top social media sites on the internet. And so I was the top user on that site. So the handle of Mr. Baby Man was actually became bigger than the person it's behind it. So
what? That's awesome. You became an icon.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of like, you know, if Lady Gaga said all of a sudden she doesn't want to be Lady Gaga, I want to be Stephanie Germanotta now. They'd be like, no, you can't. You're Lady Gaga. Everybody knows you as Lady Gaga. So,
yeah, yeah.
So
that ship has sailed.
That ship sailed, basically.
Well, cool. Andy, thank you so much for being here today and really shining some extra detailed insight, which I'm very thankful for, into a world that I think most of us didn't really know anything about.
I'm so grateful for the opportunity that you have on this show to allow me to enlighten people on this, because it's such a sometimes an arcane process just because of the lack of media there is about the process itself. So thank you very much for having the show.
My pleasure. And I imagine it feels a little bit like a thankless job sometimes, but the thing that people don't realize is, again, you guys are integral to the shows that we enjoy, because really, as most comedians will know, it's all about the timing.
It's all about the timing. And thank you very much for having me on the show.
Thank you, Andy. Bye.
Now I find myself in the wild unknown with the frogs and toads, and I'm far from home. But there's so much here to discover, one leap after another. Hop into the adventure, gotta rivet, jump on it. Welcome to Amphibia Life. Don't get much crazier.
You just heard Welcome to Amphibia by Celica Gray. The Amphibia series theme was composed by Doug Petty, with its episodic music by TJ Hill. Hill is also responsible for the music in Disney's upcoming original series, The Owl House. And with that, we come to the close of this episode. Special thanks go out once again to Andy Sorsini for joining us here on the show. Of course, thank you so much for listening in at home. If you love Stay Tuned, go behind the podcast by visiting patreon.com/PhilMackey. Subscribing there will get you access to cool rewards like exclusive interview outtakes, my cartoon reviews, and monthly video updates. I'm also inviting you to check out my original comic books at RetailSunshine.com. And be sure to say hi to me on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook under the handles of both Retail Sunshine and Phil Mackey. Don't forget to visit the ever-growing Stay Tuned community on Facebook at facebook.com/groups/StayTuners. I've been Phil Mackey, you've been a wonderful audience, and until next time, keep those eyeballs peeled, those ears open, and be sure to stay tuned.